Hello friends, I am Priyanka and I am going to read before you the book An Autopsy on English Literature written by Munir. The contents of this book is Part 1 Literary Movements, De Renaissance, De Reformation, De Metaphysicals, New Classicism, Romanticism and Romantic Revival, Modernism in English Poetry. Part 2, Eliot's Theories, Tradition and Individual Talent, Dissociation of Sensibility, Objective Correlative, The Function of Criticism. Part 3, Literary Trends, Realism, Naturalism, Symbolism, Imagism, Expressionism, Dadaism, Futurism, Surrealism, Existentialism. Part 4, Poetic Forms, The Lyric, The Sonnet, The Elegy, The Ode, The Dramatic Monologue, The Ballad, The Epic. Part 5, Dramatic Forms, Comedy, Tragedy, The Problem Play, The Revival of Poetic Drama. Part 6, Prose Forms, The Essay, The Novel, The Short Story, The Biography. Part 7, Prosody and Practical Criticism, Meter, Rhyme, Stanza Forms, Diction, Rhythm, Figures and Imagery. Practical Criticism, Procedure of Practical Criticism. Part 1, De Renaissance. The period applied to the European history, spanning roughly from the mid-14th century in Italy to the mid-17th century in England, is called the Renaissance. During this period, the European civilization enjoys a brilliant cultural outburst. The art, the literature, painting, architecture, sculpture, thoughts, and the ideas of the ancient Greek and Roman world were explored extensively and studied voraciously. The Renaissance man broke the ecclesiastical shackles and enjoyed the freedom of the mind, freedom of the body, and freedom of the soul immensely. Thus was transformed the whole of the European culture. The Renaissance also, as generally held, tolled the knell of the Middle Ages and trumpeted the advent of the modern age in the Western world. The great French historian Jules Michelet, JULESMICHELET, voiced in a famous phrase that the Renaissance is the discovery of the world and of man, and for the first time proclaimed that it was the period that saw the beginning of the modern world. According to the Swiss historian Jacob Burckhardt, B-U-R-C-K-H-A-R-D-T, the age saw the birth of the modern spirit in a profound transformation of ideas and institutions. The Renaissance, no doubt, is a fascinating period, but it is also of a complex nature. It demands much discussion and debate because it includes numerous exceptions and contradictions. One cannot fix a clear-cut date and define it categorically. Both endeavors might be impossible alike. The Renaissance is not a sudden leap from the dark to the light, but is the result of numerous and various series of events which follow and accompany one another from the 14th to the 17th centuries. The chronological limits of the Renaissance vary from country to country. In the 20th century, historians propound controversial and prodigious views and deny that the Renaissance ever existed, since all the qualities and characteristics found in the Renaissance were already present in the Middle Ages. The Renaissance can be understood and appreciated in a fuller way if one cannot have a cursory glance at the history of Europe before and after the fall of the Roman Empire. The Hellenic or Greek civilization. The earliest phase of the Hellenic or Greek civilization, before 300 BC, which leaves a tremendous imprint on the European culture, suffers a decline by the end of the 3rd century BC, but soon the Greek culture and literature appeared in the second great phase of their growth at Rome. It is called the brilliant Graeco-Roman phase. Now Rome, the capital of the ancient Roman Empire, became the center of cultural and literary activity of a very high order. The Roman Empire brought practically half a Europe under its rule. There was an all-round development in art and literature, trade and commerce, accompanied by peace and prosperity. It was an era of Virgil, Horace and Ovid. The scholars of this period were inspired by the ancient Greek masters whom they wanted to equal and excel. But this glory of the Roman Empire witnessed its decay by the beginning of the 3rd century AD. It suffered a serious blow from the Gothic race who, descending from the Danube, Danube, made an invasion on Rome, and the whole of magnificent Roman kingdom is ravaged, plundered, and shattered to pieces. In this widespread destruction, much of the literary and cultural treasure trove perished and a portion of it buried in the ground. Around the 5th century AD, the fall of the glorious Roman Empire marked the end of the Graeco-Roman phase, and the Knight of Chaos descended upon the Roman. By the 16th century, a historical consciousness was born in the minds of the Renaissance scholars. They divided history into three parts: ancient, medieval, and modern. Till now, there was no concept of the historical analysis. The past was considered as a fusion of one indiscriminate whole. The humanists in the Renaissance dated the beginning of the medieval ages with the fall of the Roman Empire and the end in the 15th century. The Middle Ages. Thus, in the European history, the period of 1000 years between 500 AD and 1500 AD is called the Medieval Ages or the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages. During this period, the whole of Europe was slumbering in a long night of ignorance, superstition, orthodoxy, dogmas, and barbarism. The Greco-Roman civilization almost disappeared in the 7th and the 8th centuries, since pagan, P-A-G-A-N, literature and thought were repugnant to the early Christians. Only a few of the clergy knew Greek. The condition of the church, swamped by corruption, had sunk to a low level. Saint Augustine, 354-430, whose writing dominated Christian thought into the 13th century, dealt with problems central to Christian faith: predestination, the origin of sin, divine grace, human will, and the nature of salvation. His most influential work, The City of God, argued that history was determined by God for his own ends. The medieval theology is otherworldly and preaches that God is the measure of all things. Man is a born sinner, a weak and doomed creature. He is completely at the mercy of the grace of God for his redemption and salvation. He has to cherish humility, charity, mercy, and the spirit of submission. He cannot think of anything except hell, heaven, Christ, God, and the Bible. Man is a slave to his senses and is liable to be corrupted. Therefore, he has to have faith in the discipline of the cross and lead a life of poverty and sufferings, of prayer and penance, to keep the soul active in the dark prison house of the body. The medieval theologist mocked at the material glory and grandeur, pomp and show, wealth and beauty, and the worldly pleasure, and praised the glory of the spiritual life. Pride, which includes ambition, was condemned as one of the seven deadly sins by Christianity. By and by, the mundane life, M-U-N-D-A-N, mundane life, receded into the background and the heavenly one came to the fore. This was the doctrine of the medieval theology, to which the high and the low alike subscribed in theory at least. For 1,000 years, the church had directed man's gaze towards the religion and made the medieval man lose the realization of his own worth and potentialities. He was just a member of a group and a member of a church. He could not exercise his rationality, the spirit of inquiry, critical faculties, and free will. Italian Renaissance. Italy is the first European country to which revolted against the medieval intellectual sterility and scholastic narrowness in the 14th century. The Italians threw ethics and religion to the wind and became anti-medieval and got dissatisfied with the vernacular literature. They were craving for a change and preached the overhauling of the entire system of education with the emphasis on the study of literature. They discovered the true meaning and beauty of the ancient world, first of the Latin classics and then of Greek literature itself. They explored the classical literature of the Roman antiquity, which was buried for over 1,000 years in the ground. It was a sheer coincidence when the Italian developed an intense love for humanities. The Turks in 1453 made an attack on Constantinople, the city known for its ancient Greek literature. And after the fall of the city, a large number of scholars fled from there and took shelter in Italy with valuable manuscripts and rare volumes. The Italians came to a direct contact with the pagan masterpieces which fired their imagination. Thus, a passionate spirit of learning is born in Italy. This great moment of human spirit is called the Renaissance in Italy and is interpreted, explained, and defined in numerous ways by scholars and historians. Italian Renaissance changed the concept of man. Now, man is the measure of all things. Man is the center of the universe, and man is the cause of his rise and fall. He is not a puppet in the hands of the unseen divine power, but is an architect of his own destiny. He realizes his dignity and potentialities. The power of physical prowess P-R-O-W-E-S-S, the power of knowledge and the power of wealth are fully appreciated. Deeply influenced by Machiavelli's Machiavelli's, the prince, they condemned morality and religion and preached power politics. They felt that man has got a very short span on this earth and he should enjoy life up to the possible limit. Thus, the cult of beauty, the beauty of woman, the beauty of nature, and the beauty of art and nature arrests the human mind. The Italians develop new personal taste, passion for decoration, elegance of life, temporal power, fresh points of view, the force of individuality, and love for personal glory. They are closer to flesh and blood of human life and have an appetite for the enjoyments of the eye and the ear. That is why Compton Rickett, Compton Rickett, remarks, "In Italy, the Renaissance thrills through the senses." Apart from literature, Italian Renaissance provided a great stimulus to the scientific and artistic revival. It produced splendid painting, architecture, and sculpture, and paved the path for the geographical and astronomical discoveries. When the Muslim power dominated the Eastern Europe, different new sea routes were explored to connect the East. Nicholas Copernicus, the Polish astrologer, gave a severe blow to the old Ptolemaic P-T-O-L-E-M-A-I-C astronomy. Earlier, the Earth was regarded as the fixed center of the universe and other planets revolved around it. But the Copernican system made the Sun the focal point around which the Earth, amidst other planets, moved yearly. The old geocentric astronomy is replaced by the new heliocentric one. The traditional theology received a crippling shock. The invention of the printing press was employed by the hero of Italian printing, Aldus Manutius, A-L-D-U-S, M-A-N-U-T-I-U-S, 1449 to 1514. In the words of Segmons, the printing press was the most formidable instrument of the modern reason. It democratized and decentralized knowledge and brought it at the doorstep of the common man. The medieval monopoly of learning enjoyed by the clergy was destroyed. The teaching method changed, intellectual barriers shattered, and the individual liberated himself from the clutches of scholasticism. this robust virility of the creative age acquired an astounding and brilliant velocity in the 15th century and enriched the intellectual life of whole Europe, Germany, France, Spain, England, etc. Fisher writes, during 200 years, 1340 to 1540, the cities of Italy produced an output of art, scholarship, and literature such as the world had not seen since the glory of ancient Athens. The Golden Age of the Renaissance in Italy came to a close with Leo's death in 1521. Before we proceed further to discuss English Renaissance, it warrants us to make clear the concepts of other two very important terms, the revival of learning and humanism, which are used pertaining to this age. William J. Long, in his English Literature, observes, "The revival of learning denotes in its broadest sense that gradual enlightenment of the human mind after the darkness of the Middle Ages. The Renaissance is more correctly applied to the revival of art resulting from the discovery and imitation of classics, models in the 14th and 15th century. But on the other hand, Professor Jebb defines the Renaissance in the largest sense of the term is the whole process of transition in Europe from the medieval to the modern order. Regarding these two terms, there appear differences among scholars, but the term humanism is quite apparent to understand. It applied to the revival of classical literature. English Renaissance. The Renaissance, though it may be traced back to the age of Chaucer, reached England much later in the 15th century and blossomed in its full glory in the 16th century when the magnificent Italian Renaissance had already exhausted. But the essence of the Renaissance remained the same and left a profound and manifold impact on English people, overwhelming every sphere of cultural scholarship, art, science, architecture, sculpture, painting, and music. The installation of the printing press by Caxton, C-A-X-T-O-N, flooded England with books and made them possible to be accessible to common man. Famous navigators and explorers such as Columbus and Vasco da Gama became a source of an inspiration. The Renaissance presented the ideal of the completely rounded man, developed in all his faculties and skills, physical, intellectual, and artistic. the accomplished courtier of the Ranisha was supposed to be able to fence, to write, to read Latin and Greek, to organize the siege of city, or to write a graceful sonnet to a lady. And in actual life, we find figures like Sir Walter Raleigh, R-A-L-E-I-G-H, explorer, freebooter, courtier, poet, and historian, Sir Philip Sidney, courtier, poet, scholar, critic, diplomat, lover, and soldier, and Thomas Campion, C-A-M-P-I-O-N, physician, poet, and composer. English people sprang up on beholding the new horizons of knowledge. With their soaring imagination, indomitable courage, insatiable thirst for scholarship, limitless ambition, desire for trade and commerce, they challenged the unexplored realm, R-E-A-L-M, of nature as well as literature. For them, individual was more important than society, and country than continent. Imbued with this spirit of individualism, nationalism, and egotism, they exhibited the glorious potentialities of man in exploration, navigation, discoveries, and thrilling adventures and exploits in foreign lands. They were fascinated by the earthly power, pelf, prosperity, and the cult of beauty. After the Ranisha, a naked woman was wrought in bronze upon the tomb of a pope. All that was beautiful was, through the eyes of the Ranisha, also divine. Ranisha English drama. The Ranisha plays a vital role in the development of English drama, bringing about a change both in the form and content. In the beginning of the 16th century, many tentative efforts and a number of foreign influences operate in drama. Like the Italians and the French, the English are far more inspired by Seneca, S-E-N-E-C-A, Plautus, P-L-A-U-T-U-S, and Terence, T-E-R-E-N-C-E, than by the Greek dramatists. The classical and Italian influences have their parts in setting the track to English national drama, which absorbs diverse elements. Different dramatic forms are chalked out: interlude, comedy, tragedy, and tragicomedy. The plays are divided into acts and scenes with the introduction of chorus and blank verse. Englishmen develop a passion for careful dramatic construction, for consistent characterization, and for organic unity, removing stiffness and formlessness from the native drama. Elizabethan drama displays all the characteristics of the Renaissance. The native religious festival plays of the Middle Ages would preach morality and instruction, but the Renaissance people demanded plays which should entertain rather than instruct. The most famous writer of interludes is John Heywood. About the middle of the 16th century, attempts were made by academic writers to write two original comedies entitled Grammar Gurton's Needle, GURTON'S NEDLE, by one W.S. and the other Ralph Royster, RALPHROISTER and Doister, DOISTER, 1550, by Nicholas Udall, in a closer imitation of the comedies of Plautus. The earlier extant regular tragedy, Gorboduc, GORBODUC, 1561-62, is written by Thomas Sackville, Sackville, and Thomas Norton, Norton, on the model of Seneca. The second phase of Renaissance drama is dominated by the university wits and achieves maturity in the romantic plays of Shakespeare. The university wits are a set of seven professional luminaries: John Lyll, L-Y-L-Y, Thomas Kyd, K-Y-D, George Peele, Robert Greene, Thomas Nash, Lodge, and Christopher Marlowe. Fired with the spirit of new learning, they all unfetter the shackles of the crabbed studies of logic and philosophy and pursue the pleasant paths of poetry. Their works are characterized by imaginative richness, sensuous beauty, colorful pageantry, delightful songs, sweet love lyrics, charming love stories, refined and cultured prose style, and the Senecan tragic horror. These dramatists highlight the significance, dignity, value, potentialities, and attraction of human life. They mainly deal with human life, human world, human emotions, and object of human interest, pleasure, and allurements, ALLUREMENTS. The thrust of the Renaissance drama is secular, temporal, and mundane, MUNDANE. Among the university wits, Marlowe, MARLOWE, is the chief exponent of the Renaissance spirit. He made man and his potentialities the main themes of his play. His tragic protagonists are men of a very strong and unflinching will, representing the true Renaissance heroism. His four famous tragedies, Dr. Foster, Faustus, Tamburlaine, Tamburlaine, the Great, Tamburlaine the Great, the Duke of Malta, and Edward II are crowning glory of Elizabethan literature. Dr. Foster, the supreme creation of Marlowe, explores the possibility of the existence of a man of superhuman dimension and superhuman aspiration. Though a man of base stock, he achieves greatness by virtue of his towering ambition, bottomless curiosity for knowledge, and boundless love for enjoying worldly pleasure. He is the true votary of beauty, beauty of nature, and beauty of female body. He cannot be satisfied with the beauty of an ordinary woman, but dies for the matchless beauty of Helen, as she appears in her apparition. Foster bursts into poetic eloquence. Was this face that launched the thousand ships and burnt the topless towers of Ilium? Sweet Helen, make me immortal with a kiss. Thou art fairer than the evening air, clad in the beauty of thousand stars. From beginning to end, Foster lives in the Renaissance and dies a martyr for the Renaissance values. Foster rises in defiance of the medieval world only to blow the bugle of the modern age. Marlowe's Tamburlaine is a sizzling, a wonderful hero, rippling with masculinity and virility. He makes the Renaissance spirit aglow with the radiance and vibrate it with his thundering voice. An unmatched adventurer, from mere a shepherd, he becomes the most powerful man in the world. All those who bow before his will are friends, and who do not are enemies. He slaughters wholesale women, children are well as men, laughs at the blood he sheds, imprisons the vanquished, and despises men and gods. Marlowe endows him with the unbridled defiance and boundless arrogance of the Renaissance spirit. Renaissance English poetry. After the death of Chaucer, we witness a blankness and sterility in English poetry. There is no poet worth naming, save a group of Scottish poets influenced by Chaucer in the 15th century. It is as if the creative energy has died out. English poetry suffers from languor, moralization, and artistic disarray, losing its grace, nobility, harmony, and inspiration. As the rosy dawn of the Renaissance gleams, it shaped the form, innovates the technique, and animates the content of poetry. The poets get preoccupied with the ancient forms and meters. They introduced the two famous Italian stanza forms, Ottova Rima, O-T-T-O-V-A-R-I-M-A, and Terza Rima, T-E-R-Z-A-R-I-M-A. Different poetic genres are discovered: lyric, sonnet, song, elegy, satire, heroic poem, madrigal, pastoral, and epigram. It is they who first practiced blank verse and used the words iambus, I-A-M-B-U-S, troche, T-R-O-C-H-E-E, and spondee, S-P-O-N-D-E-E, to denote the combination of stressed and unstressed syllables in their lines. English poets not only had a sheer imitation but also transformed the borrowings according to their will and genius and gave a tinge of the national spirit. The widened horizons in science and geography steer the minds of the poets. So the full-blooded imagination, colored with earnest human emotions, particularly love and enthusiasm and excitement, finds the best expression in a number of poets. During medieval Christianity, woman was regarded as devil's snare and pleasures of flesh as a sin, but now woman becomes an object of beauty, of love, of worship for the lovers and poets. The early Renaissance phase, 1530 to 1578, begins with the publication of Tottel's Miscellany, 1557, focusing mainly on the two pioneers, Watt and Surrey. Watt, a man of passionate and intellectual temper, is the first poet who introduces sonnet in English poetry. He has a profound love and admiration for lyric poetry, and many of his poems are translations and adaptations. Surrey, a better artist than Watt, has structural force, condensed thought, dignity, and strength in his verses. He drops the petrarchan, P-E-T-R-A-R-C-H-A-N, form of sonnet, altering into three quatrains and a couplet, which is very beautifully handled by Shakespeare. His songs of his imaginative love for Lady Elizabeth Fitzgerald, F-I-T-Z-G-E-R-A-L-D, are regular, smooth, melodious, and truly elegiac, E-L-E-G-I-A-C. But it is perhaps in some impersonal sonnets that his merit as an artist shows itself best. His greatest credit is that he introduces blank verse, which becomes the meter of the drama and the epic. After these two pioneers' tentative efforts, poetry writing becomes a vogue in England. A host of poets, Sackville, S-A-C-K-V-I-L-L-E, Gascoigne, G-A-S-C-O-I-G-N-E, Drayton, D-R-A-Y-T-O-N, Daniel, Spencer, Sidney, and Shakespeare finds their place in such collections as The Paradise of Dainty Devices, 1576, A Hundred Sun-Dried Flowers, 1573, A Gorgeous Gallery of Gallant Inventions, 1578, and A Handful of Pleasant Deities, 1584. Countless lyrics, sonnets, sonnet sequence, and songs echo the various aspects of passion of love. England becomes a nest of singing bird. The song was everywhere sung in halls and parlors, trolled along the roads. It was in towns and in the country, on the stage and in romances. Renisha English prose. During the 15th century, Latin was the vehicle of prose because English language was still immature. There was no glorious tradition of prose writing in England, and the best humanists would make use of Latin. Though some books were written in English, yet they were not free from the use of Latinism. Renisha prose is significant in the two books, Thomas More's Utopia, 1516, and Bacon's Instauratio Magna, Instauratio, Instauratio Magna, Magna, 1620, written in Latin. The later half of the 16th century was the period of the origin of English prose. The Elizabethans, with the growing spirit of nationalism and the installation of the printing press, were intoxicated with language. They were fond of words, loved grandeur methods and highly decorative modes of expression in prose. John Lyell was the first author to who introduced euphism, E-U-P-H-I-S-M, which became a craze for the other writers to imitate for several years. However, there were a host of humanists who contribute to the development of English prose and radiate their writings with the Renisha spirit. The important names worth mentioning are Erasmus, E-R-A-S-M-U-S, Roger Ascham, A-S-C-H-A-M, Thomas Eliot, John Cake, Thomas Wilson, John Colet, Thomas More, and Bacon. Among them, Ascham is an educationist, a pedant with ease and grace. His important works are Toxophilus, T-O-X-O-P-H-I-L-U-S, and The Schoolmaster. The former deals with the question of physical training in education, and the letter contains his advice to masters on the teaching of Latin. Both books have a fine literary flavor. Ascham argued that English matters should be written in the English tongue for Englishmen. Thomas More's Utopia, translated in English in 1553, is considered the first monument of modern socialism, the masterpiece of humanism, and a true prologue of the Renaissance. It is based on democracy, opposes all the conceptions of the past, and marks the new turning in the paths of thought. More has an extreme desire against the established ideas and makes fun of scholasticism, which hinders the way to thought. He extols communism, believes in the goodness of human nature, disapproves asceticism, and glorifies the senses which reveal natural marvels. As a humanist, next come Francis Bacon, whose scholarly works are charged with the electrifying spirit and stimulation of the Renaissance humanism. He desires to serve mankind by his perpetual search for truth. For him, knowledge is the chief aim of life because knowledge alone leads to power, and power increases man's empire over the earth. Bacon's rejection of the medieval scholastic philosophy and insistence on the inductive method of inquiry show his perfect attunement to the spirit of the new age. Bacon's best literary achievement is his essays, in which he pioneers a new form of literature in England. His essays is the delicious and health-giving fruit of the Renaissance humanism in other way also. It gives English prose a new powerful style, terse, analytical, and glistening with wit. The essays teaches the readers the prudential wisdom about things and affairs of life, and opened their eyes towards analysis and understanding of what they have to deal with in life. It has been well said that Bacon's essays are the epitome of the art of success in life. From all this, we can derive the ideas how significantly the prose writers fulfilled the role of the Renaissance humanists.